Hi everyone, so my name is Janine Galeon. I am a postdoctoral fellow over at Brown University, and I'm going to be your host for tonight. Before we get started with the call-in series, there's just a couple of announcements. So first is to make sure you download the slides to follow along with today's talk, and you can find those at neabpd.org or borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. And if you do have questions as we go along, or if you already have questions mapped out for today's talk, you can email those in over the course of the next hour, and that is at neabpd@aol.com. And we'll do our best to ask and attend to each one of those questions. So you can send those in at any time. So Perry, if you want to start recording, or I don't know if you already started the recording, but I'm going to give a little introduction to Dr. Shiner. So it's a pleasure to introduce our speaker for today. I'm really excited to hear from Dr. Rebecca Shiner, who's best known for her work on personality development in youth. Dr. Shiner's work seems like a natural fit for this year's GAP initiative on early detection and intervention for BPD. Her research explores the pathways through which child and adolescent personality traits contribute to the development of personality pathology. Her expertise bridges the gap between the clinical, developmental, and personality fields, and in doing this much-needed task, her work has been cited over 8,000 times. Dr. Shiner completed her doctoral training in clinical psychology at the University of Minnesota and has been a professor at Colgate University since 2000. She has served as an executive board member for ARP and was also a consultant for the DSM-5 Working Group on Personality Disorders. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Shiner, who will start off with a presentation, and then we'll follow up. We'll save the last 15, 20 minutes or so with the discussion based on the questions that everybody is sending in. So please remember to email in to us. You can get started whenever you like, Dr. Shiner.
Okay, terrific. Thank you so much, Janine. So hello, everyone. I'm really looking forward to getting this chance to talk a little bit about some of the research on personality development in young people and the ways that it's relevant to thinking about and conceptualizing treatment for borderline personality disorder in adolescents. And I'm going to do my very best to try to remember to mention which slide I'm on as I go. But my hope is that even if I forget, you're going to be able to follow along pretty easily. So I wanted to say first, so I'm on to slide two, just briefly in terms of my own background. As Jimmy mentioned, I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and my own research is on personality development in children and adolescents. So I've been fascinated for the last couple of decades by the questions of how it is that we become who we are as adults, how our personalities change and stay the same over time, how our personalities affect the way that we negotiate life tasks that we face, and particularly the ways that our personalities might affect the development of psychological disorders. I wanted to also mention that I am a fellow parent, so Janine had told me that the audience likely would include researchers and clinicians, but also potentially patients themselves and parents. And so I wanted to mention that I too am a parent. I have one of my children has Tourette's, and so I myself have listened to plenty of podcasts and webinars on Tourette's and OCD. And often would find myself feeling a little discouraged by the end. So my goal in doing this is to provide information that will be genuinely useful to parents and also encouraging. Okay, so here's what I'm on to slide three. So here's what I'm planning on talking about today. I'm going to spend probably the most time talking about personality traits because that's my area, and that's the area where there's the most research. So I'm going to talk about how personality traits may affect the development of borderline personality disorder. So I'm going to talk about what are the most relevant traits, what do we know about how adolescents' traits change over time, and what do we know about how traits affect the ways that teenagers negotiate the tasks that they're facing. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about other aspects of personality that go beyond traits. And I'm going to talk especially about what we call mental representations, coping, and then finally the life stories that that adolescents are in the process of developing. And then finally, I want to conclude by talking about some recent research on personality change. So the two big themes onto slide four are these. So first, I want to make the case that adolescence is most certainly a time, a key developmental period for the development and manifestation of borderline personality disorder. That it's something that is seriously worth trying to diagnose because this is a time where the symptoms are likely to become exacerbated and are likely to really affect people's functioning. And then the other big theme, the second, is that normal personality development processes are highly relevant for understanding how it is that borderline personality disorder symptoms emerge. So I'm taking what is called a developmental psychopathology perspective on this, and an important pillar of that is the idea that we can learn a lot about where disorders come from by having a deep understanding of normal developmental processes. All right, so let's begin talking about personality as it relates to borderline personality disorder. So on to slide five. I'm going to be using a model that was developed by a colleague and friend of mine, Dan McAdams, who has done a lot of deep thinking about what is it that constitutes personality? What is it that makes us distinct and different from each other? So I'll be following his model, and I wanted to mention that if you're interested in learning more about this personality model, I would recommend two things to you. One is a book that came out just a couple years ago, The Art and Science of Personality Development. It's both scholarly and accessible to lay people, and it really lays out this model that I'm going to be talking about here very nicely. The other source I would recommend, if you're interested, is that it was a cover story that Dan wrote for The Atlantic before the election in 2016, and it's an analysis of Donald Trump using this personality model. And so it's a really nice illustration of how this model can help you to think through an individual life. So on to slide six, the main components of personality in this model occur at three different levels. So the first is traits, which are these tendencies that we all have in our behavior, our emotions, our thinking processes, where we are at least somewhat consistent across time and also consistent across situations. And I'll be saying more about that very shortly. Then at level two are what Dan calls personal concerns. These include things like our mental representations for how we think about people and the world, our coping styles, and other ways that we vary where our behavior maybe is a little bit more variable across situation or across time. And then finally, at level three is what Dan calls narrative identity. These are the stories that we create, that we weave, we use to make sense out of who we are. And again, I'll be saying more about that shortly. So first, slide seven, I'm going to be talking about personality traits and the development of borderline personality disorder. So again, this is the area that I know the best and where there's the most research. So what are traits? Again, they're these tendencies that we have where we are at least somewhat consistent across time and across situations. And this really is the earliest emerging aspect of our individuality. So even with infants, you can see these tendencies that children have that really distinguish them from other children. Typically, people talk about this as being temperament in young people, or in infants. We don't tend to talk about the personalities of one-month-olds, for example. But really, the temperament traits turn out to have a lot in common with personality traits that have been identified in older people. So these tendencies reflect individual differences that are heritable, that have some basis in biology, and the heritability is usually, in most studies, turns out to be somewhat moderate, with about 30 to 50% of the variation in these traits being related to genetic differences across people. But even from birth, these tendencies that we have, these traits, are influenced by our experiences and by the environment. So even in the case of a newborn baby, that individual has been exposed to an environment for 9 months. And so even at birth, they're not purely genetic tendencies. Slide 9 lays out the names of the traits that have been identified as the most important personality traits in adulthood, but also in children and adolescents. And they form a handy mnemonic pattern where we can spell the word ocean with the first letter of each one. So they include openness to experience, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And I'm not going to go into detail about how researchers arrived at this list of 5 traits, but I'm happy to answer questions about it if you have any. And I'm going to now just highlight the traits that are most relevant for borderline personality disorder. So for the sake of time, I decided only to focus on those. The two that I'm leaving out are extroversion and openness to experience. And again, I'm happy to answer questions about those if you have them later. So slide 10. So the first trait that I'm going to talk about has been labeled neuroticism. Although in children, it's often referred to as negative emotionality rather than neuroticism, maybe because neuroticism sounds awfully pejorative, especially to apply to a young child. So this trait indexes our tendencies toward negative emotions of all kinds, including emotions like worry, irritability, sadness, feelings of vulnerability, feelings of insecurity. So it's really a very wide range of negative emotions. And so we each vary individually in terms of how predisposed we are toward experiencing and expressing these negative emotions. Slide 11, more recent research has distinguished 2 separable components of neuroticism, particularly in research by someone named Colin DeYoung, who has helped sort of articulate 2 aspects of neuroticism that are related, so they're correlated with each other, but they're still distinguishable. So the first of these DeYoung calls withdrawal, and this has to do with one's tendencies to get worried, easily overwhelmed, or to feel threatened and fearful. So in a sense, these are tendencies to recoil in the face of threat. The other component is called volatility, and this component has, again, it has to do with negative emotions, but it has to do more with being moody, irritable, being easily upset, easily angered by things. And so this has more to do with mood instability and with more angry, outwardly expressed emotions. So on slide 12, I've included some items taken from a measure called the Big 5 Inventory, developed by Chris Soto and Oliver John. It was recently revised, and I expect we'll be getting a lot of widespread use. So these are some of the items that are used to measure this tendency. And these are items that work, actually, for measuring neuroticism in children and adolescents and adults. So you can see the sorts of things that are there, like worrying a lot, getting nervous easily, being moody, depressed, tense. And then on the right, in the right column, these are items at the low end of this trait. So this would be low neuroticism, things like being relaxed, handling stress well, being emotionally stable, not easily upset, and staying calm. So as you can tell, onto slide 13, neuroticism indexes your propensity to experience a wide range of negative emotions more often and more intensely. And as I said, it's measurable in rudimentary form, even in infants. So even in infants, you can see differences in their tendency to cry, to be upset when they are exposed to novelty, to get frustrated when they can't get things to work or they can't get the things that they want. There's been quite a bunch of research linking this trait with borderline. And there was a recent study, a 2017 study by someone named Holly Andrews and her colleagues, where she was looking at young people with borderline personality disorder, ages 15 to 25, and she was tracking them. She was having them track their emotional experiences multiple times a day. And what she found was that these young people tended to experience complex negative emotions at the same time. And so that would be an experience where you're not just feeling anxious, but perhaps you're feeling something more complicated like anxiety and irritability and insecurity all at the same time. And what she found also is that feeling, that experience of multiple complicated negative emotions in this group of people preceded tendencies to engage in self-harm. It was also interesting that in this group of people with borderline personality disorder, that they seem to show a lower acceptance of these negative emotions, and that may play some role in leading to the self-harm that they were prone to engaging in. Slide 14, this is just an illustration that I like, Anxiety Girl. It's pointing out that this trait, neuroticism, it's tied with a lot of cognitive tendencies that people have, including things like assuming the worst possible thing that might happen in any situation or being particularly intolerant of uncertainty when you face it. Okay, so now on to the second most relevant trait, conscientiousness. So at the high end, conscientiousness involves tendencies toward organization, being planful, having high standards for achievement, being responsible. It's also related to having better attentional skills, and most relevant here, better skills in impulse control. And then at the low end, it involves tendencies toward high impulsivity, having trouble with planning, and just maintaining responsible behavior. So on the next slide, slide 16, these are items from that same Big Five inventory. So on the left, it's high conscientiousness, being systematic, keeping things in order, being persistent, working until tasks are done, being reliable and steady. And then on the right, this would be low conscientiousness, so tending to be disorganized, to be lazy. The next one was a mistake. I left it on there from the neuroticism slide. Finally, sometimes behaving irresponsibly. The next trait that I'm going to discuss on slide 17 is agreeableness. Agreeableness, I hate the name of this trait. It doesn't really do a great job of conveying the essence of what this trait is, which it really includes a lot of fundamental aspects of human nature. So at the high end, highly agreeable people tend to be considerate, empathic, kind, generous, gentle. And then at the low end, low agreeableness involves aggressiveness, rudeness, tendencies to be spiteful or vengeful, tendencies to be stubborn, cynical, and manipulative. This trait seems to be very relevant for how much people are motivated to maintain harmonious, positive relationships with other people. So not surprisingly, there's a lot of research both with children and adolescents and adults showing that people who are low on agreeableness experience more conflicts, and they also tend to use more destructive conflict tactics. And interestingly, they're just less distressed when they do encounter conflicts with other people. So slide 18, again, these are items from that same Big Five inventory. So at the high end, agreeableness involves being compassionate, having a soft heart, treating people with respect, tending to assume the best about people. And then at the low end, tendencies to be cold and uncaring, sometimes being rude to people, tending to be critical, and fault-finding with other people. So, slide 19, what are the traits that are most relevant to borderline personality disorder in young people? This is also, these are the traits that are most relevant to borderline in adults as well. So clearly neuroticism is highly relevant. A lot of the symptoms of borderline involve this kind of emotional instability, particularly the kinds of things that are that part of that volatility component. It also involves conscientiousness, not so much things like being disorganized or lacking in order, but more so the problems with impulse control and the tendency to act without thinking. Also relevant is agreeableness, so associated with lower tendencies toward agreeableness, including things like being aggressive interpersonally and distrusting. And it's interesting, this combination of traits tends to be characteristic of personality disorders in general, but it seems to be especially pronounced in people who have borderline personality disorder. Now I want to say a little bit very quickly about how young people's traits change over time, because it's important to think about to what extent are these traits stable versus discontinuous. We all know that people change to some extent. And so there's been a lot of interest in really trying to understand to what extent is there continuity versus change. So there are two different kinds of change that I'm going to talk about now. The first one is called rank order stability. And this has to do with how much do people maintain their rank relative to other people over time. So in other words, if you are the shyest person, say, on average in a sample, are you going to tend to continue to be the shyest person in that sample of people over time? The second kind of change, mean level stability, has to do with average levels of change that happen across people as they get older. So, is it the case that on average people become more responsible as they get older? On slide 21, I have a way that I'm going to try to illustrate this having to do with height. So if you think about height, you could think about it both in terms of rank order and mean level stability. So first, for rank order stability, if you look at the picture on the left, right, imagine that these kids are all the same age, but clearly they're of different heights. So we might measure them at one point, say when they're 10, and then come back to them again when they're 20. And rank order stability would tell us how much have these kids maintained their relative rank in terms of height over that 10-year period. On the right, mean level stability, this picture is supposed to depict the same girl across time. And so we could ask the question, well, what happens to people's height on average as they move through each phase of life? And so obviously in that case, there are increases on average in height as you get older, with perhaps a little bit of a drop-off as you enter into old age. Okay, so now on to slide 22 to address what do we actually know about these two types of stability with regard to personality traits. So first, slide 22 shows you the results of a meta-analysis looking at the rank order stability of the big five personality traits across the life course. So these are the average correlations between a person's score on some personality trait at one point in time and their average correlation or their average standing on that trait at a later point in time. And so what you see here, the height of those bars indicates how much stability there is in terms of people's rank relative to other people. So what you see is that as people move from, say, very young childhood then to preschool and then into elementary school and adolescence and young adulthood and so on, that rank order stability gradually goes up. So in other words, we become increasingly stable in terms of our personality traits over time. As we get older. But even later in life, there's still not perfect rank order stability, so people are still shifting around a little bit in terms of their traits. Then if you go to slide 23, addressing mean level change, this has been a hot topic, looking at adolescence lately, trying to figure out to what extent people tend to change on average in childhood and adolescence. So the studies aren't fully consistent, but so far they seem to suggest that neuroticism increases in adolescence among girls, not among boys, interestingly, but then begins to decrease overall in young adulthood. There's also evidence, and this is no surprise to anyone who spent time with middle schoolers, that agreeableness and conscientious tend to be at their lowest points, especially early in adolescence, but then increase gradually across later adolescence into young adulthood and middle age. Interestingly, though, some young people don't show these positive personality changes, and that seems to be especially true for people who may be lacking investment or experience in kind of normative adult roles, so taking on work, developing intimate relationships. And so that seems especially relevant for thinking about personality disorders, including borderline. And there is evidence, again, that there are some traits that adolescents with borderline struggle with that may prevent them from showing those same positive personality changes, at least initially. On to slide 24, I'm going to talk very briefly about how our traits affect our life path. So one of the most interesting areas of research over the last few decades has been tracking to what extent do your early traits seem to predict your life outcomes in terms of your relationships, your ability to do well at school and work, and eventually your health in older age. So slide 25, there are a lot of life paths that adolescents face, and this is part of my argument for why it's likely that adolescence is a very critical juncture in the development of borderline. Because if you think about it, adolescence presents kids with a lot of new tasks that they have to master. So they're still having to engage in academic achievement, especially more independent achievement. They're starting to chart their future course in terms of school and work. They're starting to develop more intimate relationships with their peers and potentially with romantic partners. And they're still they're negotiating more independence from their parents while still trying to maintain relationships with them. So this is a lot facing teenagers. And so people who have challenging traits may find some of these tasks more challenging. So on to slide 26. We know that personality traits, including traits highly associated with borderline personality disorder, affect how adolescents negotiate those life tasks. So, for example, high neuroticism seems to be associated with struggling. And again, these are not perfect relationships. There are plenty of highly neurotic young people who do fine, but high neuroticism often predicts struggling with all of those life tasks that I just mentioned. Low conscientiousness seems to make it harder to do well academically and at work, and low agreeableness interferes with relationships. So there's some evidence in adolescence that borderline symptoms seem to cause impairment, but conversely, that impairment can cause worsening of borderline symptoms, because when kids are struggling with those kinds of life tasks, that can lead to higher anxiety, more distress, and so on. So slide 27, in summary, traits can help to explain some of the genetically influenced borderline tendencies that youth might struggle with, these problems with emotion regulation, self-control, and relationship behaviors. But traits absolutely cannot be the whole picture. So now I want to spend just a few minutes talking about other relevant aspects of personality. So on to slide 28. So at level 2 in McAdams' model, he talks about personal concerns. And these are tendencies that we have that may vary across roles that we have or relationships that we have or vary quite a bit across different domains of life or even phases of life. And they include things like our mental representations or how we think about ourselves and our experiences or our goals, our motivations and coping. And I would argue that these aspects of personality may be especially important in the development of impairment. DSM-5 in the alternative model for personality disorders actually highlights some of these personality aspects of personal concerns and things like identity, self-direction, and empathy and intimacy in relationships. There's also evidence that when people are having trouble within these areas, it does seem to predict later worsening of personality disorder symptoms. Okay, so let me say a little bit about each of these. So slide 29, mental representations. Again, these are ways that people think about, perceive and think about their experiences of themselves and other people. And there is good evidence in borderline personality disorder that in some cases, adolescents' mental representations may be disturbed. So, for example, they may have overly positive or overly negative self-views. They may have a tendency to mistrust or to over-idealize other people. And they may have tendencies, say, toward perfectionism or toward a kind of black and white thinking where they perceive themselves or other people in extreme terms. And these disturbed ways of thinking about things tend to evoke strong emotions, not surprisingly. So, for example, on slide 30, there's evidence from research by Carla Sharp that one of the mental representations that is prevalent in adolescents with borderline is something called hypermentalizing. She gives a terrific example in this paper from 2012 where person A invites person B to dinner, but B replies hurriedly that she is unavailable because she has a prior engagement. A then assumes that B does not want to spend time with her because of a minor misunderstanding that she recalls from several years ago where A did not turn up for B's birthday party. So the idea here, hypermentalizing, involves this kind of over-interpretation of ambiguous information from other people where you're making presumptions about what is actually happening. Slide 31, another important personal concern has to do with coping strategies. Youth vary a lot in how they approach stressful situations, and this is true even for, say, adolescents who are equally high on neuroticism. They may tend to cope with things in different ways. So there's a lot of evidence, and again, this is no surprise to anyone who's spent time with teenagers, that there are a lot of less adaptive strategies that seem to emerge in adolescents, things like tendencies to ruminate, which is to ponder repeatedly bad things that have happened. Aggression can be a coping strategy or blaming other people. And some more advanced strategies don't seem to emerge until later, closer to the beginning of adulthood, things like planning or strategizing. So this is an area where chronic use of poor coping, for example, avoiding dealing directly with struggles that you might face, may lead to higher levels of borderline symptoms and also impairment. Finally, slide 32, level 3 in this model is narrative identity. This is an aspect of personality that I think is easy to overlook, but clearly becomes important once you start thinking about it. So McAdams has argued that people have stories that they tell about their lives that both reflect and create their sense of personal identity, and that this is an aspect of modern Western society. It may have been that in earlier eras, people had a narrative that was given to them by their culture, for example, from their religion. But now we really don't have an inherent story. So part of our task of adolescence is to try to develop this sense of who we are, our sense of purpose and meaning. And so the stories that we develop help us develop a sense of coherence of who we are over time. And it connects our past, which is partly reconstructed, with our present and with the future that we imagine for ourselves. Slide 33, Eric Erickson, of course, talked a lot about narratives in adolescence. He noted that in his model, his older model of personality development, that it's in when we become teenagers, our more complicated cognitive skills enable us to start developing these narratives. So how is this relevant to borderline personality disorder? This is an area where there's not much published research. And so here I'm really just suggesting some ideas about how narratives might go awry. So slide 34, there's some evidence that young people vary in terms of how much they are able to fit negative experiences into their life story. So, for example, some people have a lot of what are called contamination sequences in their narratives. These are sequences where they're telling a story about their lives, and the way they frame things is that something wonderful happens, and then something terrible happens. So, for example, I was happy about my new boyfriend, but then he betrayed me. That may be more prevalent in stories of people with personality disorders. There may also be struggles developing a coherent life story or committing to a life path. And this may lead some young people to develop on missing out on the benefits of having a more coherent narrative as they transition to adulthood. So to wrap up, I want to end by talking for just a few minutes about the potential for change, because again, I think that this research suggests that there is tremendous potential for change, that old views about borderline are likely to be inaccurate. So slide 36. So thinking specifically about borderline personality disorder and the potential for change, there was a recent study just published in 2017 tracking borderline features over time while at the same time tracking depression symptoms. And these authors found that these borderline features were just as unstable as the symptoms of depression in adolescence, which I think is a very helpful perspective, right? Because I think most of us recognize that depression may wax and wane and may improve for many adolescents. There was also a recent meta-analysis by Brent Roberts and colleagues where they looked at a huge number of studies that examined the effect of therapy on people's personality traits. So they were interested in whether interventions result in changes in personality traits. And they found that of all the traits, of the big five traits that they looked at, neuroticism showed the most evidence for change through the process of therapy. Then finally, I wanted to mention that there's a lot of evidence showing that personality can change as a result of other environmental changes. So, for example, I published a paper with my colleagues, Tim Allen and Anne Messon, last year, where we found that adolescents who experienced lower levels of stress showed positive personality changes from the age of 10 to the age of 30. So they became less neurotic over that time period, more conscientious, and more agreeable. So slide 37, I would argue that there are a lot of personality processes that potentially could be targeted in working with adolescents with borderline tendencies. It may be possible to work on changing, helping them to change their traits or learning to more peaceably live with their traits, to more peaceably accept having negative emotions, for example. It's also possible to address disturbed mental representations to help them develop new methods of coping, and I think most intriguingly, to develop a healthy life story or way of making sense of their experiences. And so I would argue that clinicians and parents alike have tremendous potential to help youth with borderline move on to a healthier life path, especially by addressing these aspects of personality. So now I am happy to answer whatever questions you might have. And on that last slide, on slide 38, there's my email address. And then I also included the references for two recent chapters that I've written with colleagues on personality disorders in young people. So I'm happy to take whatever questions you might have.
All right, Dr. Schreiner, that was a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much for sharing with all of us. I really found it to be fascinating to think about how what is typically defined as normal traits and different levels of defining personality can be beneficial for defining or understanding borderline personality disorder a little bit better. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more about how you think a dimensional model or kind of thinking of these traits on a spectrum can really help to alleviate some of the concerns that providers might have about giving a personality disorder diagnosis early in life during adolescence or during youth?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. So I know there's a tendency, I think really worldwide, for clinicians to be hesitant about diagnosing a personality disorder in adolescence. And I think and the DSM itself actually explicitly says that we should be really cautious about using these diagnoses with adolescents. My own opinion, before I share my opinion, there's also actually evidence that even in cases where adolescents are displaying fairly clear-cut personality disorder symptoms, clinicians may have a tendency just not to define them in that way. And so they may tend to look to other diagnoses instead, like bipolar disorder, and then they may end up really potentially doing damage by treating disorders that aren't really an accurate reflection of what the adolescent is experiencing. So, okay, that's a bit of an indirect way of answering your question. But so how does a dimensional perspective help? I think thinking about personality disorder as just sort of extremity in terms of normal personality traits, I think helps to depathologize personality disorders. It helps us to recognize we all have personalities. We all have areas where we may have deviations, say, from the norm, where we're relatively more extreme. And so by conceptualizing personality disorders more in terms of these constellations of relatively more extreme traits, it helps us recognize there is this potential for change. And we can use processes that are helpful for personality change in general to help adolescents be able to make these kinds of changes in their lives. So I guess my argument would be that rather than denying that personality is causing problems for some adolescents, it's better to address that in an honest way, to recognize that traits do change and other aspects of personality do change, that we can address them through therapy and through other means of treatment. And ultimately, I think it provides a more hopeful perspective.
Okay, so that actually speaks a little bit to my next question, something that you prompted about with the five-factor model that we could ask more questions about, extroversion and openness to experience. And you're talking about how these traits are, they're a little bit neuroticism, conscientiousness, and agreeableness are on more extreme ends of the spectrum. We might find more of those borderline personality disorder symptoms, and I'm just wondering if that means that what the research has found is that people with BPD tend to be in the normal range of openness and extroversion, and whether
right.
like extroversion do impact their life tasks.
Right. Yeah. So it's not that those traits aren't relevant, but that they don't seem to show the same kind of consistent patterns of extremity in borderline personality disorder. So I would say that all these aspects of personality are relevant in that they may be points of stress or actually points of resilience for different adolescents. So, for example, it may be the case that so let me just define those traits briefly. So extroversion is familiar to most of us. It has to do with how sociable we are, how much we experience positive emotions, our level of energy, and then openness has to do, it is not what it sounds like, but it has to do with how much we find complex and intellectually challenging things to be interesting and intriguing. So people who are high on that trait are drawn to more kind of intellectual stimuli, I guess I would say. So they really enjoy music or other kinds of sensory experiences. So back to the question. So what I would say is it's not that they're not relevant, but they could actually be areas of strength for some people. And that could be true for the other traits I mentioned as well, in that not every person who might have borderline symptoms is extreme in all aspects of neuroticism, low conscientiousness, and low agreeableness. It may be that there are different pockets of strength in these kinds of traits that adolescents and adults can draw on. So, for example, if it's someone who is really high on the trait of openness to experience, maybe the person tends to be clever, tends to really enjoy music and art and so on. And so there may be opportunities for drawing on that for help in coping with things, right? The person may be able to use music or other beautiful things in a way that is helpful when they're struggling with negative emotions. And I would say the same is true for all those other traits, that I think it's really important to think about places where people have strengths that they can draw on, because everyone has them.
Right, it's something that we find in everybody, or can be measured in everybody. So I guess I'm curious how you see, are there challenges with trying to measure these traits consistently when you're moving from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, because there's different ways of defining traits across those different stages of life. So in childhood, it's defined as temperament, and then as you move forward, there's different life stages. And I'm just curious what you see as challenges of trying to consistently measure traits throughout the life.
Right. Yeah, and that is definitely the case. So there are real challenges to trying to measure these traits across time. One reason is that the repertoire of behaviors and tendencies that we have expands over time. So we're just able to do more as we get older. And so that means that we might express these tendencies in a broader range of ways. So just to take one example, if we think about the trait of negative emotionality or neuroticism, in infants, it's going to be seen more in their tendency to be fearful or irritated when things are threatening to them. But it's not going to so clearly involve things like feeling insecure or having these kind of feelings of vulnerability that older kids can and adolescents can articulate. And so the way that we measure things has to become broader over time. So that's part of what makes it tricky, is it can be tricky to have an inventory that you can use consistently across a wide range of ages, at least until about, say, the age of 10. It's also tricky in that kids, say preschoolers, elementary schoolers, can as easily report on their own tendencies. And so there's been a tendency in research to rely on parent reports. And then there are all kinds of things that are tricky about parent report. For example, parents' own tendencies influence their ways of reporting on their kids. And so parents who are more anxious, for example, might have more, and there's actually evidence of this, have more negative reports on their kids. So you have this whole issue of who you go to get the report on the traits. That is more complicated in kids than it would be, say, in adults. But in the case of personality disorders, it's really important to get input from people besides the client anyhow. So I think it's really important to hear from a range of people when you're trying to understand someone's personality and symptoms anyhow. And so ideally you'd want to be getting input from a range of people, even in, say, adolescents or adults. But, yeah, so to sum up, I would say the two tricky things are that – I'm sorry. I would say to sum up, the two tricky things are that it's hard to the traits themselves change over time. They become broader over time. And then the other tricky thing is getting the right informants to report on them at different stages of life.
Right. And it seems like especially within children and teenagers that having that informant report is – going to be important. And I'm curious if you're saying, is it possible that by over-relying on parents or informant reports that you might get a misdiagnosis of personality pathology, or is that the case whether it's youth or adults or anyone?
Right. Yeah, I think it's possible that you may get an over-report or an under-report of personality disorder symptoms, depending on the parent's own level of coping with challenges from their child. So, yeah, I think clinicians have to be attentive to both possibilities when they're relying on informant reports. And then there's just the tricky issue that for, especially for kids, say elementary school age kids, it can be harder for younger elementary school age kids to report on their personalities just because they don't have that kind of comparative sense where they fall relative to other people. That also can be a little tricky with parents, especially with younger kids, because, again, parents may or may not have a broad sense of what the normal range of traits might be or behaviors might be for young people. So there's some concern even in getting reports from parents. So in general, it's better to try to get information from as many sources as is realistic.
Sure, that makes perfect sense. So I kind of want to shift with my questions, and I know it's important to think about change when we have all this information and the hope that comes with the potential for change. So I'm wondering if you have any recommendations mm-hmm. or if there's any strategies that parents or clinicians can encourage using to develop more healthy life stories or to develop more healthy personality trait development with teens or children earlier
yeah.
on to prevent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's such a good question. You know, this is an area where there's still not enough research on the best treatments to use with adolescents. You know, there's some evidence for the effectiveness of dialectical behavior therapy with adolescents. And so that whole model has the potential for helping adolescents learn how to manage strong negative emotions, both by working on changing their approach and accepting the fact that they have those negative emotions. I think it's relevant to that research that I covered that showing that that adolescents with borderline are less accepting of the intense negative emotions that they feel, and they feel compelled to do something to cope with them right away. So I think a lot of the techniques from dialectical behavior therapy have the potential to be helpful. I also think we don't have that much research really on these narrative processes in young people, but I do think that there's a role that parents can play in being attentive to that being a crucial aspect of adolescence for young people, that they are in the middle of developing these healthy life stories, and they can help to be narrating the stories of their children's lives with them, right? So, I mean, it is a process that young people have to undertake on their own, but I think that they're also sensitive to the stories that parents tell about them and sensitive to the ways that parents make sense out of their experiences that they have. So there's the potential for parents to think about, how can you help your child develop a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose? What is their sense that they are here for? And this actually is also an important aspect of dialectical behavior therapy, is helping young people to develop a life that is worth living. And I think that there's an important role that parents can play in that process. And also I think that teenagers are sensitive to the ways that their parents see them and to the stories that their parents tell them about who they are. And so there, too, parents, I think, can really have an impact.
Well, that's incredibly helpful because I know that a lot of parents do feel helpless out there. So to allow them to know that there are some things that they can shift or to do to help with that development, I'm mm-hmm. sure is reassuring. And I do have a question that was emailed in, and I'm going to try and summarize this. So hopefully this is how the listener was trying to word this. But they're asking how, or if you have any recommendations for how to help if their teenager who's demonstrating some of these traits of borderline personality disorder isn't recognizing them within themselves. So they're not seeing or lacking that insight into how their traits are coming across. And if you have any suggestions for that.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a really, I think that is such a good question. Because, as I mentioned, I think there's some evidence that the ways that that adolescents with these tendencies, that they have these mental representations that may not accurately reflect reality. So this is an answer I'm giving purely just sort of as a parent, from one parent to another, because I don't really know of research on this. But I think one way of helping with that may be partly just providing empathy to the teenager when they are suffering. Because chances are good that they are suffering during periods, especially when their personalities are giving them trouble, right? When their personalities are drawing them into situations that make things worse or are causing conflict with other people. And so I think I would suspect that if parents can offer empathy in those instances where their teenagers are, where their own personalities are fueling some of the problems that they're facing, by empathizing, it may provide an opening for helping to explore what it is that the teenager may be doing that is causing some of those problems. Now, of course, none of us really like having pointed out to us the things that we're doing that are causing our problems. So again, that's why I say that I think having a deep kind of empathy when this kind of thing is happening, and then using that as an opportunity to gently, I wonder, if there's anything that in your own way of experiencing this that might be making it a little bit harder. And I would suspect that would provide an opportunity to try to help the teenager recognize some of the things that they may be fueling in the situation.
Sure, and so those are also probably the hardest times to take that moment to take a step back to listen, which kind of speaks to how mindfulness can play. Mindfulness is such a big part of DBT and how it can play such an important part in these interactions as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I do want to be aware of time, and I want to start wrapping things up, and I'm so grateful for you dedicating your time to this talk and for giving us this opportunity to learn. And I want to remind everybody that there is going to be another talk next week, so please mark your calendars. The next podcast is going to be airing on February 4th at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and it's going to be a talk by Dr. Maureen Zalewski on what do we know about how children develop when they have a parent with borderline personality disorder. And that is going to be hosted by Andrea Gold. And I also just want to give a shout-out to please visit the neabpd.org website, and there is a spot for you to donate to the website as well. Please consider donating in any amount to support our cause like this. This is a nonprofit organization, and really we run on the donations from listeners like you. So thank you very much, Dr. Schreiner. Any last words before I cut you off?
Yeah, no, not really. Other than, again, I'm happy to answer questions if people want to email them to me.
Thank you to both of you. This was just terrific, and the back and forth made it even more special, so thank you.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
You're very welcome.
Good night.
All right, good night. Thank you.